18, 2 Kings 18. So we're now entering the portion of our study of 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles. So in this sense, we're simultaneously starting 2 Kings 18 and 2 Chronicles 29. I recognize that we have to make a choice, at least as far as which of those two books we're going to start reading some verses from. But both of these chapters are beginning with the reign of King Hezekiah over Judah. So this is a very pivotal point in our study of these books of the kings. We're getting towards the end of that, certainly compared to the beginning point. But this is a pivotal point in the history of Israel, as we now have seen Israel reduced to the tribe of Judah along with Benjamin, and then whatever remnants remain of the other tribes as descendants from ones who had joined themselves to the kingdom of Judah back in the days of Rehoboam and Asa, the kings of Judah. During those early years of the northern kingdom of Israel, when they had departed from the Lord following those sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. And we know that they never repented from that, those sins. So the Lord finally brought his judgment after 208 years of the existence of that northern kingdom as a separate entity, as the kingdom of Israel was divided after Solomon's death. But that for 208 years, 10 of the tribes of Israel had followed this Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and his successors. And so then they reached the point in 2 Kings 17 where the Lord brought his judgment on that kingdom and those tribes of the north. Well, he declared victory. I was trying to outcompete him, but I was losing. But anyway, so God brought his judgment on that northern kingdom and brought it to an end by the Assyrians, who conquered Samaria. The Assyrians carried away all of those tribes into captivity. They brought in other people from various nations that they had conquered and put in there, and those are the ones that became known as the Samaritans. And we looked at their origins in 2 Kings 17 and also traced their history down to even the New Testament time, to the time of Christ, and to see where who those people were and the source of that enmity that existed between the Jews and the Samaritans. But now that brings us to this point where everything that we look at from here onward, in fact, all the way, if we really think about it, all the way to the New Testament time, for the rest of Israel's history, all we have left now is the tribe of Judah with tiny Benjamin, and then whatever few people there were from those other tribes that had joined themselves to Judah during those years when their brethren had turned away from the Lord. So there weren't many of those. So almost all Israelites, and that's really what we've been reading about from the time that Jacob's sons became the fathers of their tribes, and Jacob, who was named by God as Israel, and so all of their descendants were the children of Israel. And we've been reading about the Israelites from that time that God made them multiply and fulfilled his promise to make them a great nation. Well, we're really finished with the Israelites pertaining to is describing all of those 12 tribes. They're no longer in existence like that. Almost all Israelites that are left from this point on, the rest of the Bible history to the New Testament, Almost all Israelites are of what tribe? Judah. Some from Benjamin, and we noted one very very prominent Israelite that was of the tribe of Benjamin that we read about in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul. He was of the tribe of Benjamin, but just about everybody that we read about were from the tribe of Judah. That's almost all that's left. And that's why they became known as, we read more of the term, especially in the New Testament, what was the word they became to be known as? Jews, which is short for Judah, the tribe that most of them came from. And so we're reading more about Jews now than Israelites as we've known them before. And this really is a very pivotal point, a noteworthy point in the history of the physical nation of Israel, because almost all of the tribes, the other tribes, are gone. That's it. They're not coming back. So all that we're going to read about as far as the kingdoms now is the one remaining kingdom, the kingdom of Judah, that southern kingdom. But now they're alone as the only one left. And the last we are reading about that kingdom, so we're not going to, up to now, the book of 2 Kings, as 1 Kings also did from chapter 12, 1 Kings 12 all the way through 2 Kings 17, mostly, predominantly was focused on what was going on, the history of those kings of the northern kingdom. But now they're not there anymore. So where we would mostly see Second Chronicles focused on the details of what was going on in the southern kingdom of Judah. But we no longer have that situation, because all we have left is the kingdom of Judah. So we're not going to be flipping back and forth between Israel and Judah, northern kingdom, southern kingdom anymore, because there's only one left. So chapter 18 in 2 Kings is telling us about the beginning of the reign of Hezekiah, king of Judah. Well, he's the only Israelite king there is now. And we're going to be reading about the same material in 2 Chronicles 29. So we're going to be looking side by side with these chapters from the two books, as they're going to be covering the same events all the way to the end. So that's what we're planning to do. From here on out, Lord willing. So rather than looking at a chapter here and then a chapter there, I mean, we're going to be, in a lot of cases, looking at a few verses in one chapter and then going over to another in the other book to look at some corresponding verses there and try to line it up as best we can chronologically. So anyway, just a preview of how we're planning to approach this now. But it's less complicated from the standpoint that we're not going to be looking at any other tribes or kingdoms in Israel, since we've only got one left. Well, the last that we've been reading about, the kingdom of Judah, who was the king? Ahaz, who was the worst one, the most wicked one that we had read about up to this point. And the Lord brought Judah low because of Ahaz and all of his transgressions. And we read how the more the Lord punished him, the more he transgressed. So finally, the Lord brought many nations to punish him, until finally the Assyrians that he had turned to help him with the other enemies that God brought against him, instead of turning to the Lord. Ahaz just got worse and worse. But here was his son Hezekiah, that just knowing what we know about Ahaz, if we didn't know anything else about Hezekiah, if we were reading this or hearing of these events for the first time ever in our lives, which is a good thing we're not, but if that were the case, knowing what we know about Ahaz, what would we expect from his son? We would expect him to be following the same track. That's what usually happens. But this is a beautiful exception to that, where we see one of the most wicked people that we read about in all of the Bible. I mean, here's a man, Ahaz, that had introduced that practice of burning their children in the fire to the worship of idols, that practice that was a part of so many of the nations around them. And that particular form of wickedness, to not seek and serve the God of heaven, well, that's evil, of course. That's the ultimate question or determinant of everybody's eternal destination, whether one is going to be seeking and serving the one God that made them. Well, if one does not, in whatever way they're rejecting God, that's evil. To then serve other so-called gods that aren't gods instead of the true God, that's certainly evil. But then to go to the point where someone is going to be sacrificing their own children to worship idols, how far can a person sink in the depths of wickedness? And we know, and we looked at that when we were reviewing that practice, when we read about that being introduced by Ahaz into Judah, and we went back then and looked at scriptures in Leviticus and Deuteronomy and traced that, where God had forewarned his people not to do that, not to engage in that practice that those other nations had. As he said, that was a major reason why he was removing them from the land and giving it to his people. But if they did the same things those other nations did, then that God would render that same judgment. Well, the northern kingdom of Israel, they had adopted that practice. And that had a lot to do, and he specifically named, God specifically named that practice in 2 Kings chapter 17 as being one of the major reasons why he finally brought that judgment on them and brought their destruction. Well, Ahaz introduced that into Judah. And as we previewed when we were studying about Ahaz, that was the start of it that's ultimately going to bear the evil fruit in Manasseh's time, who's Hezekiah's son, and where it's going to become widespread till Jerusalem is filled with innocent blood, as God describes it, which he would not pardon. And that's going to be a chief reason why he's going to end up bringing Judah to destruction, leaving only a remnant preserved in Babylon of all of his people. So all of that, all of those ones that God had made a great nation for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob according to his promise and made them to be like the stars in the sky and the sand of the seashore for multitude, he's ultimately going to reduce all of that down to a very small remnant that's preserved in Babylon. That's going to be all that's left of his people. This is going to be a major reason why. So Ahaz is instrumental, a true instrument, a tool that was used by the devil to bring down Judah. By that we can certainly see that Ahaz, with the description that the Lord gives of him and how wicked he became, and then how much influence that had on so many others to bring them to a depth of wickedness that few reach. I mean, that's going to qualify Ahaz right there as one of the most wicked people that we read about in all the Bible. To find out and to read and learn that his son Hezekiah is one of the most righteous men that we read about in all the Bible, it really is astonishing. It's extraordinary. It's astonishing. And it does teach a very important lesson that we know. I mean, as having righteous parents is not going to guarantee that that the children are going to be righteous. Everybody has to make their own choice, and we all are going to be judged by that choice. And we're going to see that, unfortunately, with Hezekiah's own son, Manasseh. Now, eventually, Manasseh does repent, but we're going to see Manasseh sinking into wickedness like Ahaz. And it's very, very sad to see and how much what the repercussions of all of that was. So the contrast between Ahaz and then Hezekiah and then Hezekiah and Manasseh, and we're reading with actual names and examples step by step of really what we've seen before in Ezekiel chapter 18, that chapter that was given to those, that remnant that was over in Babylon that had their proverb that said, "Our fathers have eaten sour grapes, and it's the children's teeth that are set on edge," they being the children. So they made a proverb exonerating themselves of any responsibility for their circumstances, their situation being there in Babylon as captives with Jerusalem destroyed, the temple destroyed, and most of the most of their brethren dead by sword, famine, and pestilence. Well, they were accusing God of judging unrighteously and unfairly, that they were being punished for the wickedness of their forebears. Our parents or grandparents are evil, and now we're the ones that God is taking it out on and holding accountable for what they did, not what we did. Well, that was a false accusation and a very evil one against God, which is what Ezekiel 18 is about. But in that chapter, he said, "The soul that sins, it shall die." In Ezekiel 18, verse 4. And then from that verse right afterwards, he spoke about if a man was doing wickedly, he would be condemned for his wickedness. But then if he begat a son that was didn't do all those things but did righteously, would the son be punished for the wickedness of his father, or would God receive him and pardon him because he did the Lord's will and was righteous? Well, yes, the Lord would receive him him being righteous. But then if he begat a son that was wicked, would his son be pardoned by God for the righteousness of his father, or would he die in his own wickedness? And then, of course, the Lord talked about, well, if the righteous then went into wickedness, would he be judged by God for the righteousness he had previously done, or for the wickedness that he turned to? Or if the wicked one repented and did righteously, would the wickedness that he had repented from be mentioned against him in the judgment, or would he be saved because of his turning to righteousness? So all that's covered in Ezekiel 18. Well, almost that precisely follows the what we're going to be reading about from Ahaz, Hezekiah to Manasseh. A very wicked man who had a very righteous son, who ended up having a very wicked son who then repented and became righteous. So it really just about every scenario there, and we can even go back one generation to Jotham, Ahaz's father, who had done righteously but then turned to wickedness. So actually, if you go from Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, Manasseh, with those four, you find every scenario that's covered in Ezekiel 18. With those four consecutive generations. So it's interesting how that follows. So we've already seen this one man that, even though he was one of four in a row, that is Jotham, who had served the Lord in his younger years but then departed from him and turned to wickedness. We've seen that. And then we saw someone who was just fully wicked all the way through, Ahaz. But now we're going to see his son Hezekiah, who is righteous and follows the Lord all of his days and doesn't turn back from it. One who belongs to that great cloud of witnesses that God has given to us, examples of faith and obedience to encourage us in following Christ. This is what we're starting to look at here with him. So that's just really a little bit of background and preview of what's to come here. So let's start in verses 1 through 3 of 2 Kings 18, 2 Kings 18, 1 to 3. Now it came to pass in the third year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. 25 years old was he when he began to reign, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name also was Abby, the daughter of Zechariah. And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that David his father did. Well, as we said, we want to look at some of these corresponding scriptures in 2 Chronicles, starting in chapter 29. And if we go there and read the first two verses of that chapter, we're going to see almost exactly the same thing mentioned there that we just read in those first three verses of 2 Kings 18. So 2 Chronicles 29, 1 and 2 says, Hezekiah began to reign when he was 25 years old, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Abijah, the daughter of Zechariah, and he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord according to all that David his father had done. That's almost verbatim the same. There are a couple of things, as we saw in 2 Kings 18, verse 1, it mentions when Hezekiah began his reign as it corresponded to the reign of Hoshea. So Hezekiah began his reign right at the time when the northern kingdom of Israel falls. So he's there. He comes becomes king at that time. He's 25 years old. Now 2 Chronicles 29 gives the longer version of his mother's name, Abijah. We have the shortened or nicknamed form of it in 2 Kings 18 verse 2. But the length of his reign, we see the same there. And how old he was when he began his reign. And then the description that God gives, that summary of his life that we saw in 2 Kings 18:3, we find exactly the same in 2 Chronicles 29:2, that Hezekiah did what was right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father, David his father, had done. Now we have seen several in our study, Joash's son Amaziah, his son Azariah, who was also Uzziah, as well as Jotham, that they did what was right in the sight of the Lord, but not like David. They did what was right in the sight of the Lord like their father had done. So we've seen some who did what was right in the sight of the Lord for a time in their life at the beginning, up to a certain point, and then they departed from the Lord. How many have we read about so far of the kings since Solomon's death when the kingdom was divided? How many kings have we read about that the Lord says they did what was right in his sight like David, their father? This is the third one. We've only seen two up to this point described, and there's only going to be one more that's coming. Josiah, who is Hezekiah's great-grandson. But Josiah will be the fourth and final one. We see Hezekiah right here. Who are the other two? Asa and Jehoshaphat, a father and son. What brought that nice succession to an end? Yep, when Jehoshaphat married his son Jehoram to Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab, that was a guaranteed way of ending the righteousness continuing for future generations. And we've looked at that and seen, I mean, how many talk about a bad decision made by a good man that had such profound repercussions, consequences for not just his own family, but for many of God's people. How many bad decisions by an otherwise good man are we going to see that had that kind of terrible consequences, like Jehoshaphat's decision to marry his son Jehoram to Athaliah? As a means of making peace with Israel, what price did he pay for that peace? It was a huge price that he paid for that. That is, and we mentioned that at the time, which is, it bears repeating. I mean, that is, because with all of these things, we're not looking at anything. None of this is in isolation. We're not looking at any of this in a vacuum. This one man, or what's happening in, it's not just a snapshot of what's happening in Judah or other tribes of Israel at this, just this one moment in time. All of this is connected. And what we see with any of these individuals and God's people as a whole, it's connected to prior events in their history, and how that has led to certain situations that these ones are in, either things that they then overcame or temptations that they fell to. But that's one of the, and we've certainly seen that with, I mean, with what culminated in Ahaz, with his reaching that depth of wickedness right here, just before Hezekiah comes along, right at this point in this in our study. I mean, this is not just, we didn't just end up with Ahaz out of nowhere. I mean, Ahaz comes along as a product of a lot of that's been going on for quite a few generations. And it's been a spiritual decline in Judah over many generations. And we can trace it back to what Jehoshaphat did when he married his son to Athaliah, because the only bright spots spiritually that have occurred in Judah since then was when Joash was young, Athaliah's grandson, when she had ordered the murder of all of her own descendants so that she could be queen. And this was after her son had been killed by Jehu. But when that happened, and Jehoiada, the high priest, who was the paternal uncle of Joash, well, he was married to his father's sister, and they brought him up, their nephew, as their own child. But Jehoiada, and obviously his wife, they were very righteous, and then they raised Joash from a baby as their own, and Jehoiada was a righteous man and taught him the Lord's ways. And he was the one leading the kingdom of Judah as what we would call a regent, while the king Joash was a minor. But, I mean, the decisions, the rulership in Judah was by Jehoiada. So there was that bright spot under while Jehoiada was alive, and Joash followed the Lord as long as Jehoiada was alive, which is why Jehoiada was buried with the kings. So we had that bright spot where you had a righteous leader in Judah who happened to be the high priest, the regent for when Joash was king until Jehoiada died. But then that's when Joash turned away from the Lord. And then you have his son Amaziah. You had a brief moment, a period when he served the Lord until he turned away from him. And then the same with Azariah or Uzziah. And then Jotham. So other than those little brief moments, the direction, the overall direction in Judah spiritually has been downhill until it reaches the depths under Ahaz. And you can trace all that back to a decision a righteous man made, Jehoshaphat, a very foolish decision that he made as a compromise to make peace with his brethren. It's one of the great object lessons in that. What happens when we compromise truth in order to try to get along with somebody, to make peace with our family or somebody else? If we're going to compromise what's right in the sight of the Lord, and if we're willing to do something that's against the Lord's will, in order to try to make peace with somebody, I mean, the Lord tells us in Romans 12 to, as much as lieth within you, make peace, live peaceably with all men. Well, is that as much as lies within us to compromise the truth and to do evil or foolishly against the will of God in order to have that peace? That should not lie within us. That's beyond what should lie within us to do to be at peace with anybody. And we can see what happens when a compromise is made with truth. And do any of God's people, Christians today, make such compromises to get along with what family members or others, whether it's their associates or co-workers, and even maybe other religious bodies, denominations and things? I mean, you can see this not just on individual levels, but even congregations have done things and compromised the truth for things like that. But does that ever please the Lord? Is that going to be something that He blesses and gives increase to bear good fruit? And anytime we're tempted in that, we should remember Jehoshaphat and what happened there. That's one of the ones that should be right there in our minds that we never forget. Because look at all this. Look at what happened and how long it lasted. I mean, in this sense, I mean, it's not going to... it's really a permanent scar on his not just his family but his tribe. I mean, the way it turns out over the years, it leads to things that and events where things would never be the same. So that was a very tragic decision that he made that did a lot of damage to a lot of people. Well, Ahaz made some very bad decisions. They weren't compromises and foolish decision that an otherwise righteous man made. No, this was a fully wicked man, Ahaz, that made numerous wicked decisions that had terrible consequences for his family too, but and for his kingdom and for God's people. But with Hezekiah, he was a personal witness to the things that God did to punish his father for his wickedness. He was right there to see all those things. What choice did he make? He made the choice to follow the Lord. He saw what his father did and what God did about it. He also had the object lesson of the northern kingdom right next to him, and he has this going on simultaneously. He sees what happens to within Judah, within his family. He sees what's happening to their brethren of the north and their destruction. He sees all of this work God is doing to punish all of this wickedness. This starts right there in his own house. He sees all of that, and what does he decide? I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do these things that have led to God bringing these punishments on these people who are doing these things. He made the decision he was not going to be like his father. He was not going to be like his family. He wasn't going to be like his brethren. How many people in Judah at this time are faithfully serving the Lord and not involved in wickedness and idolatry? I mean, let alone all those ones in the northern kingdom that reached their final destruction when he's watching that too. But how many people were there among that would have been very out in the open following the Lord and doing his will that were around for Hezekiah to look at. There weren't many, but he was willing to decide to follow the Lord anyway. So when we look at that description that he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that David his father did, that is a beautiful description of anyone's life if given by God. I mean, this is God's own statement about him. And as we've seen, of all the kings, he's only the third, and there's only going to be one more that are described in that way. And we've gone through the numbers before, and it's not difficult to do that. But of all the kings since Solomon, of the northern and the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah, each had 19. That comes out to 38 total kings after Solomon with both kingdoms. And of the 38, 0 out of 19 were righteous in the northern kingdom. They all followed the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. And of the 19 kings in Judah, only 4 were righteous and did what was right in the sight of the Lord, like David. Only 4. So that's 4 out of 38. And then when we add in the 3 that came before the split of the kingdom, Saul, David, and Solomon, we know Saul was wicked. So, I mean, when you look at all the kings that Israel ever had, I mean, it's 41, and there were 6 who were righteous out of 41. So looking at those numbers, judging the spiritual effect of being under kings and how that served the nation, served God's people, how would we judge or grade that? They wanted a king to be like the nations around them. Remember that in 1 Samuel 8, and that's when God said, okay. When they rejected God's system of the judges, and the Lord warned them in that very chapter in 1 Samuel 8, well, here's what it's going to be like under the kings. With that system, when you have what determines who's going to be your next king? He's going to be the son of the one that just died, or he's going to be the general that just murdered the predecessor, as in the case of the northern kingdom many times. But it's going to be determined by birth or violence. How does that guarantee righteousness in that king? Not at all. And the Lord warned them. That was a system. They wanted to follow the world system and not what God had given them. Now, of how many times did, under the judges, starting with Moses, all the way through Samuel, and all that we're told about, called by name, with Moses, Joshua, and then all the other ones, Othniel, and Ehud, and all the other ones that we know about, Gideon, and Jephthah and Samson, Samuel, but all those judges from Moses through Samuel, the last one, how many of them were righteous? All of them. I mean, God chose them for that reason. All the judges were righteous. God chose judges, righteous men, or in the case of Deborah, when there weren't any righteous men, a righteous woman, to deliver the people and to be their judge, and the people would follow the Lord in righteousness all the days of the judges, whoever they were. God always chose the best, and that's why he chose them. They could be from, he chose them from all kinds of different tribes and families. He chose the best, and all the judges were righteous. In Hebrews 11, how many of them were named there? Or described, as far as when he summarized, we see them, many of them called by name in Hebrews 11 as part of a great cloud of witnesses. The judges are part of that. God chose, that was the system God chose for them, and he gave them the very best, and they always got a righteous leader when God chose them as their judges. They didn't want that anymore. They rejected that, and they chose kings. They wanted to be like the nations around them. Well, how does it turn out? Well, here we have a very rare case where you actually have a righteous king in Judah. But this is to Hezekiah's credit that he chose to serve the Lord in spite of all of the wickedness that was in his own family, as well as the kingdom that he was a part of and the overall nation that he was a part of, and wickedness everywhere. Wickedness of depths that we've not. I mean, this is really, if you combine Israel and Judah at this time when Hezekiah becomes king, it's as bad or as worse as, I mean, you could say, okay, well, during Ahab's time overall and the effects that Athaliah had in Judah, but I mean, this is right in there with that kind of that time. Certainly, one of the very worst, lowest points that we do read about for all of God's people during all of this history of the kings, and this is when Hezekiah comes along. So where we might expect to see a very wicked man in a circumstance like this, we have Hezekiah, who was very righteous. Now, what would have happened if Hezekiah had been here, if he'd seen all these lessons and he chose righteousness, but it just so happened that he was among Ahaz's sons, but not the heir? Then what would Judah have ended up with? So if we want to look at this as just by sheer chance, as some random event, the fact that Ahaz had a righteous son at all is remarkable. But for that righteous son that he had to be the actual heir that becomes their king, if the birth order had been wrong there or something of that nature, then and he just happened to have a righteous son, but he wasn't a king, then how would that have benefited or impacted the entire kingdom of Judah if he weren't the king? Wouldn't he just have been a footnote somewhere, perhaps, that this wicked King Ahaz happened to have a righteous son that didn't really do much good for the whole nation because his brother who became king was wicked like his father? I mean, if that's the way the history was, then it would be very different, wouldn't it? But we know that's not the case. And we know that Hezekiah wasn't just a righteous son from a wicked father, but he was the heir to the throne. So that made this to be something, and we can't, and this is the point right now, we're not going to say, well, that was some real good luck there that Hezekiah happened to be the heir to the throne being righteous. Well, no, this wicked man has a righteous son. And who's the one that's making sure that he is the one to reign as king over Judah, so that his righteousness is going to be for the good of all of God's people that are left at this time? I mean, this is God's work. Now, we don't know the particulars of any of his brothers, we do remember in 2 Chronicles 28 and verse 7, in Ahaz's time when God was bringing these punishments, it says, "And Zichri, a mighty man of Ephraim, slew Maaseiah, the king's son, and Azrikam, the governor of the house, and Elkanah, that was next to the king." Now, what are the chances that those ones that got slain there that he names were wicked men? This would have been one of Hezekiah's brothers. This would have been the governor of the house and the one that was right next to the king. What are the chances any of them were righteous? Virtually non-existent. The mention of Maaseiah there in the midst of all of those, is it possible Maaseiah, that he may have been the heir to the throne? We don't know. We're not given that detail. But we just should consider that God did what he did in verse 7 there of 2 Chronicles chapter 28. Whatever God needed to do to make sure that Hezekiah, this one righteous man that came out of all this, would actually be the king of Judah, however God did it, God did it. I mean, that's what we need to recognize. And he very well could have used what we see in chapter 28, verse 7. That might have been part of his work to remove other wicked ones that were right there to open the door for Hezekiah to be in that position. Whether it was directly that or other events that we were not even told about, we know that God made sure that this righteous man was in that position at that time. Reminds us of what Esther said about, or what Mordecai said about Esther, that she was there in the position that God put her in as queen for such a time as she was there for, and how it benefited all of God's people. These things don't happen by chance. They don't happen by accident. It's not luck. This is God's work. What he did later with Esther, I mean, clearly God did this with Hezekiah. The fact that there was any righteousness that came out of Ahaz's family is truly remarkable. But God certainly made certain that that man got to be king of Judah and got to rule over his people. And so that righteousness that was in him became a blessing and a benefit to all of God's people. So let's keep that in mind as we read further. Now, back in 2 Kings chapter 18, verse 4, he's going to start to tell us some of the specific things that Hezekiah did as king. In verse 4, he says, he removed the high places and break the images and cut down the groves and break in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made. For unto those days the children of Israel did burn incense to it, and he called it Nehushtan. Now this is interesting that we read about not just the fact that he got rid of these high places and the idols and things. And we would expect that a righteous man who becomes king and now has the authority as king in this environment where you had such widespread idolatry, what are we going to expect that he's going to do right from the start of his reign? Well, he's going to tear down and get rid of all of this, this wickedness. Now, we're not going to go there now, but in 2 Chronicles 29, where it picks up in verse 3, it's going to tell us what he did in his first year. And the actual first thing he does is he opens up the doors of the temple and has that reopened because it had been shut up in the days of his father Ahaz. So God's temple was not being used at all. So Hezekiah immediately has the temple opened up, refurbished. So he's getting that done. At the same time, he's destroying all of these high places and groves and idols that are throughout the land. So he's doing everything right here from the start of him, his becoming king. But it is interesting that he mentions this, with all of this idolatry, that it mentions this particular object here, that the brazen serpent that Moses had made. And how the people of Israel were actually worshiping that thing, and so he destroyed it. Nehushtan, by the way, means something made of copper. That's what the word. When I looked that up, I was expecting something more. I guess something a little more traumatic than what it turned out to be when it says he called it Nehushtan. He just called it something made of copper. But anyway, it obviously wasn't special to him. Moses made that. Shouldn't that be preserved? What a sad thing. And we know what there would have been a good reason to preserve that particular object. There were certain objects from Israel's history that were preserved and directed to be preserved by God as objects to remember lessons from, ones that were placed in the Ark of the Covenant, which there were three objects that were placed in the Ark of the Covenant by God's direction from Israel's history. And they all have great lessons associated with them. What was the first object put in the Ark of the Covenant? The stone tablets that Moses brought down, the second set. The first one, we know what they got broken. But the second set, with what was written by the finger of God, the Ten Commandments on the tables of stone. Well, those very tablets were in there. Now it's not like the people could go and look at that as an exhibit, but they would know it was in there. The Ark of the Covenant was in its place in the most holy place in the temple, and what was in it would have been known, and there was a reason why those tables of stone were in there. That was to call to remembrance Israel, that they were God's people, and they were under his authority and commandments, and the very tables that he wrote with his own finger, what he commanded them to do, that was preserved in the Ark of the Covenant. The other two things, a pot of the manna, where they had that daily miracle, a miracle 6 days out of the week for 40 years to sustain them in the wilderness. And that was in there. And then the rod, Aaron's rod that God made to bud, that signified how he had invested not just the tribe of Levi, but Aaron and his descendants to be the priests in Israel, and only the descendants of Aaron. And so God made that clear by making his rod bud. When you had the rods of all the other tribes that didn't bud or bear almonds like was done with Aaron. So that signified what God had determined by his authority, who could be priests in Israel. So those things were in the Ark of the Covenant. So we had some objects from Israel's history that had important lessons to it that were preserved there at God's own direction. They had their memorial feasts that would commemorate certain events and things by God's direction too, like the Feast of the Passover that was in their first month, and the obvious lesson, what they were supposed to remember from that. Now we don't have any record that God commanded them to keep that brazen serpent that Moses had made. But that was back in Numbers chapter 21, when Moses did that. God's the one that commanded Moses to make a serpent and put it on a pole. So he made the brazen serpent in Numbers chapter 21. God told him to do it. This is when he had sent serpents among the people who were biting and killing them, plaguing them because of their murmuring against the Lord. And then he told Moses to put a brazen serpent on a pole, and when they would look to that, then they would be saved from their bites that would otherwise have killed them. Well, that object got preserved. Now, what should they have remembered from that? Don't murmur against the Lord, and remember to trust the Lord. That would have been a good reason to preserve that object for a memorial. Now, we know later, the Lord, why did he command Moses to do that in the first place? Well, that was a shadow of Christ and him being lifted up on the cross. According to John 3:14 and 15, and that object is mentioned there by Christ himself, and that was a shadow. So did the Lord make sure that such an important shadow of his son being lifted up was preserved? I mean, obviously, up to this point, yes. But the sad thing is, what they took that should have been something to remember, the Lord's deliverance and a reminder to trust the Lord, and boy, did they need to remember that during these days. But rather than that, then they started worshiping that brazen serpent on the pole. That became another idol, where they actually worshiped that image. And so what did Hezekiah do with this stumbling block? Even though it was, going back to the time of Moses, this would have been a very treasured piece of their history, or should have been, but he destroyed it. And he did so because it was a stumbling block to all the people that were worshiping it. So that's how much he regarded that object at this point, when it was used like that for that purpose. We're out of time, so we're going to go to our Heavenly Father in prayer, and we'll resume our study here, Lord willing, next Lord's Day.